Thanks for listening to Matt McLaughlin History. Become a subscriber to receive exclusive bonus episodes, ad-free listening, early access to all episodes, and special member-only events. Click on the link in the show notes or visit patreon.com/mmhistory.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello podcasters, it's Matt here, and I wanted to invite you on a very special journey with me in the footsteps of the Anzacs. If you've always wanted to visit the Western Front, now is the time to do it. I am leading an exclusive tour in June this year, so it's only a few months away, and we are going to walk the battlefields of the Western Front through France and Belgium in the footsteps of the Australian soldiers. And the best news is I'm joined by a very special guest. It's Ray Martin, the famous, iconic Australian journalist and TV presenter. He's going to come with us, and he's going to share his experiences of reporting on history and studying history, because Ray actually studied to be a history teacher before he became a journalist. In addition, he's a wonderful photographer, so he's going to share with us his techniques and his tricks and tips for getting the most out of your holiday photos. It's going to be a wonderful journey. It's about 10 days, departs from Paris in early June. It's going to be a really wonderful trip. So please come with us, walk in the footsteps of the Anzacs on the Western Front. It's the only tour I'm leading this year to the Western Front. So if you want to come and walk with the Anzacs, I'd love to see you over there. For more information, visit battlefields.com.au.
A Living History production.
This is the Living History Podcast, broadcasting live across the airwaves.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Living History and to an episode that I think will be confronting but is an important story that we tell, because this month is the 75th anniversary of the Sandakan death marches in the Second World War, probably the most horrific chapter of several horrific chapters for the Australians in the Pacific War. And I wanted to look into this. It's an important story. It's one we probably don't know enough about. And to join me to discuss it is Lynette Silva, AM, who is probably Australia's leading historian on the Sandakan death marches. Lynette, thank you so much for joining us on the program.
It's a pleasure.
Now, give us the backstory. How did these poor Australians end up in these Japanese camps in the first place? Because the story of the death marches is that the Australian soldiers were prisoners of the Japanese, and then in 1945 were sent on these forced marches from camps in Borneo. How did these men end up in captivity in the first place?
After the fall of Singapore, the Japanese found that they had tens of thousands of prisoners of war who should have killed themselves rather than get captured. So they were mouths that had to be fed, and the Japanese decided to make use of their labour. I'm sure everybody's heard of the Burma-Thai Railway, where that consumed thousands of prisoners. But in July of 1942, the Japanese started to send the first batch of Australian prisoners to Sandakan in British North Borneo to build an airstrip. 1,500 went with the first batch, another 500 followed the following April in 1943, and they were joined by about 700 British prisoners. This gave them a labour force of about 2,700 at the Sandakan camp, and their job was simply to level the land, clear it, and build a military airstrip for the Japanese. So that's why they were in Sandakan, the only reason.
That sounds like pretty tough work in the jungles of Borneo for men who'd been captured and who were probably not in great conditions. Just paint us a picture for what it was like, that labour to build that airfield.
Well, the labour was gruelling. Fortunately, the British had already decided to build an airstrip for defence reasons, and all the big timber had been taken down, but there'd been regrowth, which was scrubby, and in the jungle, vines grow literally overnight. So there was a fair bit of clearing to go on. They had no tools other than pick and shovel and little baskets, and their task was to level out the bumps in the land and to make it suitable to land military aircraft. They had to work 6 days a week, The guards in the beginning could be quite difficult, handed out quite a few beatings, but they had plenty of food, 770 grams of rice per man per day. And if you imagine 770 grams of rice being cooked up, it's a massive amount. This allowed them to trade with the locals at the airstrip, and actually in the first few months people put on condition. They were quite happy with their lot. It was probably no better or worse than any other labour camp the Japanese had, but it wasn't until 1943 that things started to go downhill. And that is because the Australians were in league with a local underground movement. They'd built a radio, and the senior Australian officer involved had obtained arms from the Philippines, which were hidden in the jungle in order to have a possible uprising against the Japanese. Well, when this was found out by the secret police, or Kempe Tai, they swooped on the camp, and from then on things went dramatically downhill for the prisoners of war.
How much of the camp, the fact of the numbers of prisoners that were there, the conditions they were in, how much of this was known by people back in Australia, the authorities back in Australia?
Well, nobody knew anything. They didn't know that where the prison camp was or how many people were there until 8 Australians who were with the second party that came across in early 1943 managed to escape from the island that they were on temporarily and go to the nearby Philippines. Now, the Americans were there with the Philippine Liberation Army working against the Japanese, and they were able to get messages back to Australia. Yes, there was a prison camp, and eventually when the Australians were extracted in 1944 back to Australia by submarine, a plan was put in train to rescue these prisoners of war. So it really wasn't until they could get them back and debrief them on what was going on that they had any real idea of how many were there and what they were doing.
You said that things started to go downhill in 1943. Tell us how conditions changed in the camp at that time.
Well, the Japanese, of course, were infuriated to find out that there was a very active underground movement working in Sandakan with the local people, and this had spread to the prisoner of war camp, and that they were intent on, having an uprising. They found all this out and dragged large numbers of prisoners off for interrogation, which really meant torture. The locals were also tortured terribly and gave up names, and bit by bit the number of people involved got larger and larger until the Japanese had enough information from confessions to take a good number of people to trial. And they went down to Kuching in Sarawak, where the main POW headquarters was, and were put on trial there for various crimes. Some were quite minor, others were capital charges. And at the end of that period, 8 local people and the senior Australian officer were executed. And that took place in early 1944. Well, back at Sandakan, things tightened up considerably. The guards got tougher, the surveillance was much stricter, little privileges they'd had were cut back. And towards the end of 1944, the Japanese were not in such a good position as they'd been previously. From the military point of view, they were losing the war. And as things got worse, Borneo was cut off by the Americans. They had submarines patrolling the coast. They had planes in the sky. And no storeships were getting through to the Japanese in Borneo, which meant that the food was being dramatically reduced. And, of course, the prisoners of war were also in this same situation. So gradually, from 770 grams of rice per man per day, which was what they started off with, by the time they got to the beginning of 1945, the rice ration was cut to 70, 1/11. The reason this happened was because with the great amount of rice they had previously, the Australians had been canny enough to store the excess rice. The Japanese found out about this. They cut the issue to zero and told the Australians they had to use what they had in the camp. Now, they didn't know how long the war was going to go on, so they reduced it to about 100 grams per person per day and then cut it back eventually to 70. Now, the reason why they were able to last for some weeks on such reduced rations was that the Americans had bombed the airstrip out of existence at Christmas of 1944. So we now had a big pool of prisoners of war. The death rate had been quite low. Less than 100 had died until the end of 1944. But now the Japanese had all these people to feed and no one's doing any work and therefore they're surplus to requirements. So the solution was to decide to send about 455 of the fittest across to the west coast to be used for labour over there and also to carry equipment for the Japanese from the east side of Borneo to the other. Now, I did said that the Americans had cut off Borneo with their submarines and planes. There was no way they could move these prisoners by sea, so the idea was to make them walk. Because things had been getting difficult with the supply situation, the Japanese had set up a supply route overland through the mountains. They didn't cut the track. They went to local headmen, who, of course, loathed the Japanese. They were very pro-British. And when they were told they had to cut this track from one side virtually to the other, they decided to route it the worst way they possibly could. And they spent a lot of time working it out. They went through crocodile-infested swamps, up mountains when they should have been following easy river valleys, through terribly dense jungle, into a great section of the middle part of Borneo, which had not even been surveyed by the British. It was unexplored and uninhabited. So the idea was to make life hard for the Japanese, and to their horror, they discovered at the end of January of 1945 that this group of prisoners of war was going to be sent across this track.
Well, I'd like to get to the specifics of the march in a moment, but something you touched on there that I think is really important is the relationship between the Japanese and the local people of Borneo as well. Just tell us a little bit about that, because these people really suffered as well, didn't they? It wasn't just the prisoners.
Oh, the local people had a terrible time. About 15% of the population died under Japanese occupation. Anybody who was Chinese was automatically highly suspect, because the Japanese were very pro. The Chinese were very pro-British. The local Malays that were there, weren't many Malays living there, they were kind of just kept themselves and they were prone to accept a bag of rice to dob somebody in and give information. But the Chinese in particular were very stoic and they paid for it dearly. After the Americans started to bomb Sandakan, the Japanese decided that the locals must be in league with the Americans who had now started to retake the Philippines. And therefore, they rounded up these people and beheaded them in lots of up to 21 at a time, tortured them, did terrible things. But despite that, the Chinese did not yield, amazingly brave people, and still continued to assist the prisoners of war at the camp where they could. And this was also done by the local indigenous people, a tribal people called the Dusuns. And the Dusun people were all Christian, very pro-British, and on the death march in particular and at the camps at the end of the death march, it was the Dusun people who did what they could to help the prisoners and save the lives of six who actually escaped.
So it's early 1945, mm-hmm. 75 years ago, the Japanese have decided that they've got all these surplus prisoners, that the camp is no longer where they should be kept, so they're going to march them into the interior and to the other side of Borneo. Just tell us the story of that first march.
Well, the first march was split up into groups of about 50 or 55, nine groups each, one day apart. The prisoners were reasonably fit. I mean, the food hadn't become a serious issue until a few weeks before, and they were all pleased to be leaving the camp because they knew the conditions there were very bad. The Japanese had told them they were going to a much better place, so the ones that were picked were actually quite pleased to be going. And as they went out the camp and went to the main road going down to Sandakan, instead of turning left towards the harbour, they turned right into the interior, and that's when they realised things were not going to be good. They would have had a very good survival rate had the Japanese been organised enough to have the food dumps worked out well in advance through these uninhabited areas. The local people who cut the march track had deliberately routed it away from any villages because the Japanese were using it and they did not want Japanese troops anywhere near the girls in the village or anywhere near the young men where they could be taken off for slave labour. So the route was, by the way it was worked out, was through an area where you could not get any food. The food was that the prisoners had was dependent solely upon the food dumps the Japanese had set up. Well, it was all right for the first couple of groups. By the time group three turned up, there'd been no replenishment. And just before one very difficult mountain climb, one group of 49 Australians had six cucumbers to last them for the next 4 days. And that was a period of marching for them over the next 4 days, which saw five of them shot on one particular mountain because they simply could not make the distance. These men were now reduced to crawling on their hands and knees. They knew that if they faltered and couldn't go on, they would be either bayoneted or shot. And that gave them great impetus, of course, to keep going. They didn't know where they were going, had no idea what direction they were going. They couldn't see the sun. It was in thick jungle. They thought perhaps if they could make the end of the day, they might last another day to get home to see mum or their wife or their children, whoever it was. And so that was a great incentive to keep going. But even the strongest ones, in the end, with such poor food and the gruelling terrain, they were walking 16 kilometres per day, perhaps longer, depended on the situation, and some of them inevitably fell by the wayside. Now, there was a killing squad that came along at the rear, and they killed anybody left behind. But by the same token, the Japanese were killing their own men who could not keep up. Japanese military regulations state that anybody who is in a retreat situation and cannot keep up is to be, quote, disposed of. Disposed of means kill. So they had no compunction about shooting their own men and definitely no compunction about shooting prisoners of war. Of that group, despite the conditions and the lack of food and being beaten up by guards who were urging them to go faster, three quarters of them made it to their destination, which was a little village on the side of Mount Kinabalu, Southeast Asia's second highest peak. And they were kept there because they couldn't go any further to the west coast. The Allies were now bombing the west coast, and the Japanese did not want the prisoners of war to be there. They wanted to keep them and hold them back. The hut they were in was by... not by chance. The hut they were in was just simply a native hut, open-sided, and there was not enough room for all the nine groups to fit. So the first five groups went on ahead, and the groups six to nine remained at a village about 26 miles away, about 40 kilometres away. As they stayed there for about 5 weeks, dysentery broke out, and that was really debilitating. That wiped out a large number of prisoners of war at that little camp, and also wiped out a large number of prisoners at the main camp at Ranau. So after about 5 or 6 weeks, enough had died in both places to amalgamate them into the one little camp.
How far had this group marched from the original camp?
That's about 260 kilometres.
That's...
The full distance.
That's extraordinary.
The first group... one group did it in 14 days. The longest, I think, was 17 or 18 days to cover the distance. And when they got to the end, there was no salvation. The conditions there were absolutely horrendous. There was definitely not enough food. Prisoners were reduced from hunger to if they were lucky enough to find an unripe pawpaw growing somewhere in a native garden, to steal it and then grate it up and even grate the stalk as well to try and get something to eat. Some prisoners were sent back to the village where the second group was waiting with food, not particularly for the prisoners but for the Japanese who were stationed there guarding them. And they were rice-carrying trips of 26 miles, 40 kilometres. That took them 2 days. The sacks weighed about 20 kilograms, and they would load up at Ranau to cross two mountain ranges to reach the little village. That took them 3 days to get there. They would then have a rest that afternoon, and it took them 2 days because they weren't carrying anything to come back. And those who were strong enough to go on rice-carrying trips actually had a better chance of survival. Now, the reason that was because they were now in an area where there were native gardens. So they could steal stuff, they could hope the natives might give them something, and they were also very keen on listening out for the local dogs And at night, when they were supposed to be sleeping at just under the stars on the track, the couple would sneak away and go back to where the dogs were and kill the dogs, and that would give them additional meat. They also realised that the rice sacks they were carrying had been stitched with quite big stitching at the bottom of the hessian, and that if you took a piece of hollow, thin bamboo and inserted it in the bottom of the stitching and put the other end into your water bottle, you could drain off some rice. So they did this, and that meant that the rice carriers, as long as they didn't get sick, were able to get additional food that wasn't possible back at Runner. So one of the survivors, Keith Bottrell, he did the rice carrying 5 out of the 6 trips. He realised that there were ample opportunity to steal food, get food, and it got you out of the camp, which people were just dying like flies from dysentery. So that got him out of there for 5 days, had a 2 days rest when they came back, and they'd start again on the Monday, and off they go again for walk number 2 and 3 and 4 and 5.
There were several transfers of prisoners from the camp across the mountains, weren't
yes,
there? It wasn't just one march. There were several marches that took place over a period of time.
Yes, the first march had the 9 groups, and they were 1 day apart. The rest stayed back at the camp and probably would have stayed there, except at the end of May, the Allies really bombed and attacked Sandakan. This was carried out on the 27th of May, and it was a strategic, deliberate attack to divert attention away from the west coast of Borneo, where the Allies were going to have a massive invasion on the 10th of June. So the idea was to lull the Japanese into a feeling of false security, for them to believe that any attack was going to come from the nearby Philippines, which were now pretty much in MacArthur's hands, and therefore the big invasion would come from the east. And, of course, the plan was from the west. Now, the plan worked brilliantly from our point of view. The Japanese were convinced that invasion would be within 2 or 3 days, and the prisoners were convinced as well. So when the Japanese realised this, they decided to move 500 prisoners who could still walk, and I use the term very loosely. They would move them into the interior to Ranau, where they were making a stronghold for their last stand. 288 who were not capable of going or were ambulance men who were looking after the very sick remained back at the camp. And they didn't mind at all because everybody was convinced that within a couple of days landing ships would arrive, paratroopers would be jumping out of aeroplanes, and their ordeal would be over. One of the ultimate survivors, one of the 6, Nelson Short, had terrible ulcers on his toes so that his sinews were showing. And one of the people who was to remain at the camp, who had malaria, said to him, Nelson, don't go. They won't make you walk with feet like that. Stay here. In a couple of days, we're all going to be on a ship lying between clean sheets and the most gorgeous nurses looking after us. And he decided to go with his mates. And, of course, ultimately that saved his life because nobody who was left at the camp survived. There were 288. About 62 were sent on what was the third march, which was middle of June. And of those 62-odd that were sent out of the camp, they didn't make it more than 40 miles of marching. They were all dead by the time they reached there. The others kept going. The local Chinese were very brave and pushed food under the wire to them. And so instead of dying very fast, they hung on. And it was soon obvious that there was going to be no invasion. So the Japanese were told that when the last prisoner of war died, that they were to go into the interior and join the rest of the Japanese forces. Well, the prisoners took their time dying. To hurry up the process, on the 13th of July, and keep in mind that they'd been in this little sub-camp, just being looked after by a few guards from the end of May, so they're still going okay. 23 looked as if they had no intention of dying. Now, these must have been people who had malaria and had got better, right? They didn't have dysentery or beriberi. And the Japanese obviously told them they were going to be evacuated because they left the camp carrying all their possessions. And when they got out to where the airstrip was, they all lined up along a ditch and all murdered. The rest then conveniently died off in dribs and drabs. One fellow was horribly killed. He was crucified for stealing food. terrible story. And then eventually the numbers were down to 2 alive on the night of the 14th of August. And one was a tall, skinny fellow from, even skinnier now, of course, from Tenterfield. His name was Johnny Skinner, I found out later, after I did some research work on who he could be. And the other one was the complete opposite, short and stocky. And in the next morning, the 15th of August, the short, stocky one had died during the night, and that left Johnny Skinner still left alive. He came out of his shelter, of a little tent he had made out of blankets and old ground sheets. He was lying there, and the Japanese came across from their barracks, hauled him out, marched him up to the slit trenches where all the ones who died had been buried, blindfolded him, forced him to his knees, and with one tremendous swipe of the sword, the camp commandant that was there decapitated him. Now, that was at 7:15 in the morning on the 15th of August, and 5 hours later, Emperor Hirohito announced that Japan had unconditionally surrendered. Now, the murder of Johnny Skinner wiped out the last of those who'd remained at Sandakan, which brought the death toll there to 1,400. Most people think that all the prisoners went on the march, but they didn't. The majority of them remained behind at the camp, and there wasn't a single solitary person survive. About just over 1,000 left the camp on the 3 marches, and the second march was in much worse shape than the first march. Now, they had ulcers on their legs that were showing their leg bones through. They looked like the pictures people have seen, I'm sure, on TV and in books. All their ribs sticking out and, you know, really skeletons with skin over them. That's really what they looked like. They took a whole month to cover the distance that the previous march had taken just over 2 weeks to do. And the death toll from on the second march was much higher on the actual march itself. About 2/3 died en route. About 1/3 reached the far end. When they arrived, they found there were 6 alive from the first march. 6 out of 455 were alive from the first march. And those 6 joined the 183 survivors of the second march in a remote jungle camp south of Ranau. The Japanese had moved everyone down there because the Allied planes were circling, dropping bombs and, you know, generally bringing the war much closer. They kept them there, and the usual illness, dysentery, broke out. They didn't have any shelter. They started to die in quite large numbers until eventually they all died there at that camp, apart from 4 who escaped. And they were looked after by local people for some weeks, some of them. 2 had escaped earlier on the death march, and they'd been looked after by villagers, Zusan villagers, living along the river closer to Sandakan. Now, one of those escapees, Braithwaite, he was picked up by villagers quite soon after he escaped, and they were able to get him down to an island in the big bay north of Sandakan, where they knew the American PT boats came past regularly to shoot up Japanese camps along the river. So they waited there, and they flagged down the Japanese, the Americans, and Braithwaite was the first one rescued. And by the middle of June, he was blurting out this story that he, with 500-plus people, were being marched into the interior. And that was the point at which we realised that there was no way now that they could be rescued. It was all just too late. So those 2 that escaped early on lived to tell the tale. They were taken back to the Americans and looked after. The other 4 had to remain hiding in the jungle in the mountains up near Ranau until Australian paratroopers parachuted in after the war, and they were taken to safety, and they were able to tell the story of what had happened. But the atrocities didn't finish with the decapitation of Johnny Skinner back at Sandakan. There were actually 33 people left alive on the 1st of August, and on that day the Japanese decided to murder 17 of them in cold blood. They just killed them. The other 15 that were still alive, they hung on, 10 other ranks and 5 officers, and they were doing quite well. They were still alive 12 days after the war ended. was now the 27th of August. The war had finished on the 15th of August. They were still alive. And the officers were told that they were going to go back to Ranau town to talk to the Kempe Tai officials there, and obviously thought they were going to discuss terms of their release. They knew the war was over. Allied planes had circled all round, dropping leaflets to say war was over. The 10 other ranks were told that they were to go to a village to collect some vegetables, and I'm sure they were pleased about that because the food was pretty awful. And the two groups went in separate directions. The five officers were told, it was a very hot day, why don't you sit down on the grass here by the side of the track, have a little rest before you go any further. They sat down, not realising that it was their last moments on this earth, because the guards with them across the other side of the track levelled their rifles and shot every one of them dead. The 10 other ranks met the same fate, except they were told they were going to die, and they were killed one at a time with a shot through the head just to the south of the camp. So those murders, they were terrible. On the 15th of August, 12 days after the war ended, finished off the last of the prisoners of war and brought the death toll for everybody to 2,428. I said earlier that the labour force was up to 2,700, and that was correct. But officers and a lot of others were moved to another camp, and another 100 were moved off to a separate camp. So that left 2,434 people in the camp. And as I said, six people survived, which left the death toll as 2,428.
Six survivors out of about 2,500 men.
The death rate was 99.75%, which makes it Australia's worst disaster of the Second World War. I mean, we had ships sink like HMAS Sydney and the Montevideo Maru, and hundreds of people drowned, but we didn't have a wipeout like this anywhere. Nowhere, even on the Bermatile Railway. The deaths up there for Australians were about 2,500, but we had, you know, about 10,000-12,000 working up there. So the Sandakan rates up there as the worst atrocity perpetrated against Australians in the Second World War, and it's one of the least known.
You're telling me this story and I'm just in shock. I mean, I'm just sitting here shaking my head. It's the ultimate barbarity against human beings. What happened to the Japanese that carried this out?
Well, the camp commandant, and he was hanged, along with the two Japanese officers in charge of the marches. A number of others were hanged as well. Some were found guilty of brutality rather than murder, because the war crimes investigators and the prosecutors were finding that it was very hard to make a murder charge stick. We've only got six survivors, remember? And sometimes if there was insufficient evidence to prove a murder, the Japanese were let go because that was what the charge was. So they started to dumb down the charges. And where they knew there'd been murder taking place, they put the charge down to brutality. So those Japanese might have got 15 years or 20 years. Some of the murderers got life rather than be executed. But in the end, it didn't really matter what it was, because by 1958, there wasn't a single solitary Japanese war criminal behind bars. And the reason for that was the Americans were very keen to get Japan back on its feet, which is the reason why the emperor wasn't charged. And they were very keen to make an alliance with Japan against communist China and communist Russia. So this was the political reason behind this supposed goodwill. Australia hung out. We pursued war criminals until 1950. The British and the Americans had long given up. We were still after it. The Americans were hounding us to stop bringing people to trial, but the Australian government was adamant that we're going to make these people pay, and consequently the last of the great war criminals that involved with us were hanged up at Manus Island in 1951. We kept those that were sentenced to terms of imprisonment there, and then the pressure was put on us to allow them to go back to Japan, where they could stay in Sugamo prison in Japan so they could see their relatives, which I think is the ultimate irony, considering the punishment that had been meted out to our prisoners of war. You know, this was being very soft line was being taken. Eventually we were forced to do that, and by 1958, because of various petitions for leniency, there wasn't a single solitary war criminal left in Sugamo Prison in Tokyo, and the prison was destroyed. So when we've had today in Australia, where we have POW relatives who are very bitter against the Japanese punishments and what was they actually were made to serve, I can understand why. Because if you were lucky enough, Japanese, to be tried in 1950, even if you got a life sentence, the maximum you were going to serve would be 8 years. And the maximum that any prisoner, any Japanese prisoner served, was 13 years. So you need to know this to understand why there's still a lot of bitterness amongst relatives. They really don't think justice has been done.
One of the controversial chapters of this whole saga was that there was talk at various stages during the war of an Allied invasion to liberate the camps, and that never occurred. Tell us a little bit about that and the story behind that and why it's controversial.
Well, I don't think it's controversial because I know why it didn't take place. But back in 1944, when those eight, there were six alive still, two had got killed fighting Japanese, were taken back to Australia and they told the story of the camp and what was going on, a plan was put up in the middle of 1944 to send in paratroopers to rescue these prisoners of war. Now, General MacArthur was in charge of the whole area, so you couldn't do a thing in his patch without him saying that it was okay. And he endorsed this plan. The people involved in Special Operations Australia were commando-type people who were going to be inserted behind the lines. They had very good plans worked out, but for some reason the hierarchy dithered around for ages and missed the monsoon. Now, when the monsoon season starts in Southeast Asia, you cannot land people from submarines or do anything like that. And so they missed that window of opportunity and they had to wait until the conditions got better, which was in the following January. A series of terrible... it was total mess. Stuff-ups is the word I'd use, took place, which meant that the specialised team going to go in at the end of January didn't actually get there until March. When they did get there, some bright spark had decided, instead of sending a specialised team in to collect the intelligence for the rescue plan from the prisoner of war camp, that everybody could go into a new insurgent spot a long way to the north of Sundakan. Now, the party leader, because there were just only five or six in the group, the party leader said that this was sheer lunacy. There's no way he could do this reconnaissance work from up there. And he was told to use the local people to gather intelligence, which he had done on a previous mission in the further south in Borneo the previous year. So he made the contacts. The locals were quite happy to help collect intelligence, and they set up a line of communication between Sandakan area and where the Australians were based. There was one big problem, though. The Japanese had decreed that anybody who came within 400 metres of any prisoner of war was death. And so the locals were very, very frightened about making any contact with anybody at the camp. So they relied on people living on the outskirts of Sandakan to give them information. And these people reported that hundreds of prisoners of war had gone marching past their houses into the interior in January, the end of January and into February. Now, these people were numerically illiterate. It must have looked like a lot of people. You've got 455 at least going past, plus all the Japanese troops going with them that are being evacuated, going along. And the word that came back to us, right up in the jungle, miles away from the action, was that the camp had been evacuated and that they expected confirmation within a fortnight. Well, within a fortnight, which was about... The first message came out at the beginning of April. In the middle of April, about the 10th or 11th, a second message came through from our people in the field to say that they'd received confirmation that there was nobody left at the camp at Sandakan, and the party leader recommended bombing at the earliest convenience, which meant that now our prisoners were now going to be starting to be bombed by our own side, and some actually died as a result of that bombing. So the plan here in Australia was they were very perturbed. They said that in light of the information received about the prisoners of war, the behind the lines party would now be doing other things. So they went off and did other things. The paratroopers who were practicing and been held up at the Atherton Tableland in Queensland were all sent on leave. A fleet of ships which had been detached, the British ships which had been detached from MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Fleet, were all sent back from Leyte Gulf in the Philippines, where they were waiting with their landing ships' infantry to evacuate people. And an Australian squadron, which was sent to Moratai, we had our own aircraft, we had sufficient aircraft waiting there for the paratroopers to come, were sat around swimming in the lagoon for a fortnight and were all sent back to Australia. Because everybody believed that there was nobody left in the camp. And it wasn't until Braithwaite was picked up when he escaped early on the 2nd March and was taken back to the Philippines and blurted out this story, was that everybody realised that the intelligence was completely faulty. And it was now too late. It was just too late. They'd all gone into the interior and the whole rescue mission fell apart. Now, it's controversial because some people don't believe it could be carried out. Now, I believe it could be. The guards that were left at Sandakan were described by the Japanese as third rate. There were very good drop zones. And had we received last-minute intelligence, had somebody locally or from our secret group gone in and made contact with the prisoners of war, they then could have had the last-minute intelligence to know when was a good time to mount this mission. And in actual fact, the Americans had tested our plan in a place called Los Banos in the Philippines in February that year, using one-third the paratroops, 200, instead of six, we had 600, one quarter the aircraft. They parachuted in at 600 feet at 6:45 in the morning, having found out from ground agents that the Japanese were doing PT in their undies at that time of the morning and that all their arms were in the barracks. The paratroopers came into the camp and within 15 minutes had secured the camp and liberated it. 2,000 people. And not a single solitary prisoner of war was lost in that mission. Two paratroopers were killed. So the plan had been tested. Americans had shown that it could be done. But the big difference between the American rescue and our planned rescue was that we didn't have that last-minute intelligence. Nobody actually went up to the camp to find out where the machine guns were, where the guard huts were, anything else. And therefore, the mission just fell apart because, as far as Australia was concerned, there was nobody left in the camp to rescue.
Lynette, this whole sad, traumatic tale, do we in Australia know enough about it? I mean, there's a feeling that everyone knows the name of Sandakan. Everyone sort of knows that there was a march. Do we remember it in the right way?
Well, I don't think that's correct. I spent the last 30 years trying to raise the profile of Sandakan, and with a group of 14 little relatives in 1999, we held the first Anzac Day service there. Now, it took me about 8 years to build up enough interest by talking to the ABC and the Sydney Morning Herald and, just generally on radio, to eventually get the Australian government to realise that this was something worth doing. And so now there is a commemoration each year on Anzac Day. But most people look blankly at you, say Borneo, and they don't even know where it is, let alone Sandakan. So although we've raised the profile a bit, it's not on the nation's lips in the same way as we've got Kokoda or Gallipoli or El Alamein or any of the Western Front, all of those big names that we know. This is a very neglected part of our history, and the reason for that is twofold. The first is that when eventually we got our people in there after the war and they went there with high hopes of finding people at the Sandakan camp or at the prison camps, and when they discovered that everybody was dead except for six and that the circumstances of the death were horrific, the government with the army decided that this was all too terrible to put on to relatives of these prisoners of war who'd spent since February 15th, 1942, when Singapore fell, wondering about the fate of their prisoners. So therefore, they would just tell them that they died while prisoner of war in Borneo, and that's exactly what the telegram said. The relatives tried to get those in authority to have meetings with them to give them more information. It was a silence. No one was saying anything. Now, that was not sinister. It was a poorly advised paternalistic attitude. They thought that they were... The authorities thought that they were saving these relatives from more heartache, but in actual fact, they were compounding it because they wanted to know what had happened. And because nothing was said, the worst-case scenario, because ultimately little bits did leak out, it was known eventually, because of the war crimes, that one prisoner had been beheaded. But that was one out of nearly 2,500. He was the only one. Because no information was given out, that became the norm. Stories about the death march came out, how about people had been shot. That therefore, everybody got shot. And there's a plaque on a memorial over there in Sandakan put up by Bruce Ruxton and the Victorian RSL, which says categorically 2,700, which is the wrong number, Australians and British prisoners of war were marched to death on a death march. So what we have is 2,700 people being killed on a death march when really 1,000 went on the march, and of that, half got to where they were going and the other half died on the way, and the majority never left the camps. So you can see the story's already getting very distorted. But because of that, we've had huge distortions of the story, and we've had relatives who've not found out anything. That's why I call my book Sandakan, A Conspiracy of Silence, because there was a conspiracy to withhold information from families. The other side was more sinister. That was Special Operations Australia side, which was headed by General Blaney. He actually headed this group. And when they discovered that this rescue mission, which had been called off, had been wrongly called off, and that everybody had been left to die, irrespective, the Special Operations files were filleted. And this is why I got interested in the story, because I found that small document that said, in view of the news about the prisoners of war, that the special party will now be diverted to other areas of investigation. And I thought, what news about the prisoners of war? So I went down to Canberra and I thought about it on the way, and I realised that the only thing we knew about this rescue mission was that General Blamey in 1947, at a reunion dinner for the paratroopers, had said categorically, when he was asked the question, why were we training up on the Atherton Tableland? And he said, oh, there was a plan to rescue the prisoners of war, but fate decreed otherwise. Just as we were ready to go in, all the aircraft were required by a higher authority. Now, the higher authority had to be General MacArthur, so he moved the blame for this onto MacArthur, and MacArthur had the blame for this failed rescue mission because he was so mean-spirited that he hadn't given us 30 aircraft out of the 600 he had. And that was tremendously suspicious to me, because General MacArthur loved people to love him. And he had plenty of aeroplanes. And I knew, because the work I'd done on the mission, that he had sanctioned this rescue plan from the middle of 1944. So why would he, with only 2 weeks to go, say, no, you're not having any aircraft? So this all sent me down to Canberra. I got into the working file of the rescue mission called Operation Kingfisher. And it was the neatest operational file I'd ever seen. I'd seen hundreds of them in the work I'd done. And I went through it and I'm thinking, where's the intelligence reports coming out of the field? Who's in the field? According to this file, there's nobody in the field. And I knew they were there. Where are all the movement orders? Where are all the intelligence summaries? Where are the signals coming out of the field? Because this was a working file. And I realised that although in that file were all the plans on how to rescue the prisoners, right down to the loading of the aircraft, that's how good the file was, there was nothing on the secret side. And I thought, somebody has removed the information. And I nearly gave up, but I realised that nobody, even the secret side of the war, keeps one copy of anything. So I started to look through secondary files, which couldn't be filleted because they contain multiple amounts of information on reports. And lo and behold, it's 17 minutes past 3 in the afternoon. I remember it distinctly, looking at my watch. I found a decoded signal which said, "We have reliable information from a village chief that all prisoners of war have been moved from Sandakan to the west coast of Borneo. We expect confirmation within a fortnight." And my heart dropped to the floor. I felt sick, physically sick, and I thought, they can't believe, they cannot believe they've all gone, because it was the 2nd of April. And I only knew I knew the first march had gone. So I went through the file, and there was the second signal decoded from the field that said, "We now confirm there are no prisoners of war left at Sandakan." And that's when I realised that this filtering of this information had been very deliberate at a secret operations level. It was very easy to keep it quiet, because secret operations ceased to exist the minute the war finished. Anybody who had been with them was bound by a set code of secrecy that lasted for years, and so this was very, very easy to suppress, that there had been this diabolical disaster and that this rescue mission had been, you know, just hopelessly planned and not carried out, and that we'd lost, well, at the time they should have been rescued, there were about 1,000 left alive. So that was the second strand of the conspiracy of silence. One was from being an act of kindness that went wrong. The second one was very, very deliberate.
So we know that Australians don't remember this as they should. If you had your way, what would the legacy of these death marches be?
Well, the legacy of the death marches has actually come across in a real way by the families of the prisoners of war. They're the ones that have left the legacy. They felt so bereft that these men had been neglected, not remembered, that they joined with me in a couple of initiatives that we've got over there in Sabah. The first was to put in fabulous stained glass memorials windows in the stone Anglican church at Sandakan, where the prisoners spent the night when they came off the hill ship from Singapore before they were marched to their final captivity and death. They all spent the night in this beautiful church. It was built like a cathedral. So stained glass windows were put in there, and those windows were also as a thanksgiving to the local people who gave their lives in some circumstances to help them. And these people had not been recognised either. So we had two prongs here. That went on, and that raised the profile of the Sandakan story a bit. I discovered that there were very talented Dusan girls living in the interior who had no hope of going past the end of primary school because their families were subsistence farmers or fishermen on the big rivers, and therefore they had no hope of a life outside the village. As soon as they got 16, they'd be married off to somebody. So we set up the Sandakan Memorial Scholarship Trust. In the beginning, we started off very small. I was giving talks to people who wanted to hear about Sandakan and not asking for any fee or any travel expenses, just asking for a donation. And it started to snowball. We got people very interested in this, particularly the relatives of POWs, and now the trust is fully fledged trust. We have up to 16 girls per year now being educated to up to the end of secondary school. We've had a large number, about 11 or 12 so far, graduate tertiary level. The last one with a degree in biotechnics. Now, these are girls who would have been condemned just to live in the village, get married and have babies, and the whole poverty cycle would start again. So this is the great legacy, and that's why it's called the Sandakan Memorial Scholarship Trust. We also have a lot of other initiatives which people can see on my website, which I won't go into. But the legacy, that legacy has come from the POWs. The other legacy that the prisoners of war have left us is this amazing legacy of friendship and being bound to the local people. Because we all suffered terribly, the local people and our prisoners of war suffered terribly in the Second World War, that was the beginning of the wall, friendship wall that was going to be built. Then Australia came in after the war. Although British North Borneo, as it was called then, now called Sabah, was under British control, it was the Australian government who rewarded those who'd helped prisoners of war, given them food, sheltered them, saved their lives. And for the 8 local people who were executed for helping us in the camp, those widows were given a pension. Now, this came from the Australian government, so this raised our stocks considerably, as you can imagine, because the British weren't giving them anything. Then we went into the area of the of the emergency, Malayan emergency, and the confrontation in 1963, when after the British went, there was a power vacuum left and the Indonesians were going to come and take over British North Borneo and Sarawak. Australia sent troops there, as did other Commonwealth countries, and once again, Australia had come to the help of the locals, as we had done, which I forgot to say, at the end of the war, because Australia liberated Sabah. The 9th Division went in, and we invaded all of Borneo, and then we were the occupation troops, and we brought all the food in and looked after all the local people. So now we're this wall of friendship we're building's getting higher and higher. It's got a very good foundation from the prisoners of war, but now it's getting better and better. So we've got the confrontation. And then in the 70s, it was Australian money and know-how that built the roads. And so Australians were over there for a lot. We had a lot of contact. And now when you go over there and they see a lot of our group, you know, they have a little flag on or something, the locals will say, "Oh, you are from Australia. Welcome to Sabah." Now, they really mean it. They don't mean that around the corner I've got this my very nice sister, very nice, you know, going to cost so much, as you do in other countries. They really mean it. They don't want any money. They'll give you the shirt off their backs. And so the real legacy that we've got from our prisoners themselves is this incredible bond of friendship, which no other country enjoys the way we enjoy it. It's really incredibly tight. And people here now that know about the story recognise that it's a two-way street. Back during the war, the locals did what they could to help us. Now I have no trouble at all getting funds to help out people over there. We've built a little preschool in a very poor village. It's been fully equipped. When there was an earthquake over there and houses were destroyed in one of the villages, the government in Sabah wasn't helping. These village people had no insurance. And I sent an SOS out through my network here and said, "Look, you know, want to help?" And the money poured in. Sufficient money for us to provide all the building materials to build the destroyed houses in this little Dusun village, because the Dusun people actually did the building. So this is ongoing, and I hope that, you know, long after I'm pushing up daisies, the friendship that was started off by our POWs and has been nurtured and swelled by our Australians here that are interested in the story, especially families, I hope that those benefits are going to go on for years and years and years to come.
Well, it's wonderful work, Lynette. If people want to find out more about it or contribute, where can they find out more
just
about your work?
Just look on my website, www.lynettesilver.com, and it says Contact Lynette. So you just contact me. And if you look on there, you'll see lots of the initiatives that we've done in memory of these POWs, such as the preschool and the scholarship trust and the windows and piles of reading. You could probably spend 2 or 3 weeks reading it. Look on there, and if anyone feels moved enough, oh, yeah, sure, contact me. And also, hopefully, they might feel inspired to go over to Sabah themselves and just to see what a wonderful little country it is and how friendly the people are. They're just amazing.
That's very well said. Lynette Silver, thank you so much for joining us to tell us this this tragic story.
Thank you.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.